And welcome to the 9th episode of Season 9 of the Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I am Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray. We should be doing a flaky episode, Ray.
Do you think?
Well, it's 99, isn't it?
Very good.
Yeah.
If you're outside the UK, you may not understand that, but just Google it. It's fine. What's on the agenda today, Graham?
Well, I think there's a clue in the title, Ray.
That's one of your Latin puns, isn't it, Graham?
Well, it is. Would you like to explain?
Well, only because you've explained it to me previously am I able to do that. The word trivia originally comes from the Latin for a meeting of three roads or paths. It morphed into a more general sense of found everywhere or commonplace, which is where today's generally accepted usage comes from.
Excellent. Very good explanation. Except... In this episode, right, we're going to go back to the original meaning, the crossing of three paths.
And what three paths might they be?
Well, actually, it's three stories, but you get the idea. I mean, you can only take a pun so far.
Do you really believe that, Graham?
Well, I think occasionally we stretch them to breaking point.
But yeah, go on.
Anyway, so these three stories are one, the collapse of FTX, which is caught the headlines a little bit. Mm-hmm. There's been a ruling by the Court of Justice of the European Union, which has exercised some of our colleagues' minds somewhat.
Yep.
And there's a story from the UK about Lady Moan and COVID.
Yeah. Now, this is all going to need a fair bit of unpacking, actually.
Well, I think it is. And while for those who don't know her, Lady Moan might sound like the pseudonym of a soft porn film star, it is in fact a baroness who sits in the House of Lords and who made her money from selling saucy underwear.
So not that inappropriate a name, though.
Maybe not, but I think, Ray, for the sake of potential litigation and our inability to afford lawyers, we should emphasise that Lady Moan, actually, correctly, Baroness Moan, has never been associated with the porn industry in any manner whatsoever.
And just to emphasise that point, the spelling is M-O-N-E.
It is indeed.
As to connections with porn, I guess if you wanted to contrive a connection, you might think that some of the actors in those dramas might have potentially chosen her products.
Well, that's a fair point, but I think we should move on while we're
I think so.
So maybe we should start, Ray, by summarising these three rather different stories before we discuss why there might just be a common thread running through them.
Okay, so let's start with probably the Welsh...
The Welsh.
Okay, let's start that again. Okay, let's start with probably the most well-known, the collapse of FTX and the fall from grace of Sam Bankman-Fried.
It's Freed. I thought he was fried.
I think he's Freed.
I think you're probably right.
I mean, I can go and check.
No. I'm sure you're right. And I wouldn't want to grill you about it. That would be.
Oh, sorry. Please.
Yeah. And I mean, his fall from grace and that of FTX is actually one of those rare instances where the use of the word spectacular is just not an overstatement.
I think you're right. The story starts back at the beginning of November, seems so little time ago, when rumours started circulating about the financial strength, or the absence of financial strength, of FTX and its sister company, Alameda.
Yes, and as I understand it, part of the problem was caused by FTX using its own cryptocurrency within all of that schmozzle, and it's called FTT.
Yeah, now this isn't going to be an episode about the intricacies of the FTX balance sheet or crypto trading, but suffice it to say that the lack of any solid underpinning of some of these crypto assets meant that when investors started to pull their balances from FTX, it had a negative impact on the price of FTT, which then appears to have created a death spiral for the company.
That's such a great expression, isn't it? Death spiral.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, that resulted in the appointment of John J. Ray III, no relation, as the new CEO, responsible for managing the administration of the company on behalf of the debtors.
And Mr. Ray is no stranger to these situations, having performed a similar role at Enron some years back.
Well, indeed. I think his appointment here was followed 6 days later by what I can only describe as a rather remarkable document.
And I think we need to quote from that, Graham. This is what people come here for.
Well, I think we should. And we won't be the first, but it's still worth doing. He starts on page one, listing the firms he has contracted to work with him on locating the assets of the company.
Yeah, which are Alvarez & Marsal, Sullivan & Cromwell, Nardello & Co, Chainalysis, Kroll, and a confidential cybersecurity firm.
Yeah, and you've got to say amongst those rather illustrious names, confidential cybersecurity firm just sticks out a mile.
It does a bit. I mean, what firm is so secretive you can't even say its name?
I don't know, Ray, because they don't name it.
Oh, very good, yeah. Now, Mr. Ray goes on to list some of the very numerous law enforcement and regulatory agencies who've been in contact, including the US Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the US Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, the US Securities Exchange Commission, and the US Congress, among others.
That sounds like a whole heap of trouble.
It does, but it's paragraph 5 in the early section that really catches the eye.
And which has already been quoted quite extensively.
It has, but it's such a quotable quote, I think we ought to quote it again.
Well, I think you should, Ray.
Yeah. After providing a resume of his 40-year career, Mr. Ray says, quote, "Never in my career have I seen such a complete failure of corporate controls and such a complete absence of trustworthy financial information as occurred here. From compromised systems integrity and faulty regulatory oversight abroad, to the concentration of control in the hands of a very small group of inexperienced, unsophisticated, and potentially compromised individuals, this situation is unprecedented." End of quote.
I thought you did that. I mean, first go perfect. Good job.
Now, you'll have to take our word for it that that was first go, listener.
It genuinely was. Now, given that we live in a world, Ray, where reports habitually couch themselves in rather vague and generalised terms, this use of language is about as unprecedented as the situation he found at FTX.
Oh, I completely agree. And while we could probably talk for hours about the report in its entirety, it's the section on asset location and recovery I want to focus on.
Okay, but on the way, we should at least point out that apparently Alameda Research LLC published accounts showing a total of $13.6 billion on its balance sheet, and they hadn't actually been audited.
And astonishingly enough, Mr. Ray has doubts as to the veracity of those accounts.
He also points out that the network of companies which form what he calls the Alameda Silo are located in Delaware, Korea, Japan, the Bahamas, Australia, Panama, Turkey, and Nigeria.
And that's relevant to the meeting of our three paths, so hold on to that thought.
And another sentence that caught my eye along the way, I know we're heading to the assets, but it was one under the human resources heading.
And what did that say, Graham?
It said, and I'm going to quote, "Repeated attempts to locate certain presumed employees to confirm their status have been unsuccessful to date."
And that truly is astonishing. And presumably there's a whole lot of mischief they could have been up to whilst having their status unsuccessfully confirmed. Or perhaps we should say successfully unconfirmed.
Well, Ray, if you were being cynical, and let's be honest, that's probably the best approach. Yes.
And then we get to the assets.
And straight away, Mr. Ray confirms that there were no appropriate books, records, or security controls in relation to its digital assets.
And let me stop you there, Graham. Imagine if this was a traditional bank we were talking about.
Well, that's actually very hard to imagine, Ray, because the regulator would have spotted something was wrong long before they had the number of clients and the volume of what is now alleged assets on its balance sheet.
And that's an important point, I think. At one level, what happened at FTX is something that could have happened in any firm. Lack of governance, lack of controls, lack of oversight. There are lessons to learn here for anyone involved in commercial activity well beyond financial services.
Well, I agreed, but I sense there's a but or a however coming, Ray.
Well, I prefer however of the two.
I thought you were being something of a grammatical pedant, but away you go.
However, there is this residual feeling that crypto, because it's new and complex and exciting and people are suffering from FOMO.
That's fear of missing out for the uninitiated.
Yeah, whatevs, granddad. Because of that, crypto is afforded a degree of, for want of a better word, leniency that other more traditional firms might not get.
Well, like unaudited accounts for a $13 billion balance sheet.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. And then we come to the unauthorized transfers.
That's not a good phrase, is it?
Well, it doesn't conjure up optimism and feelings of goodwill, Ray. No.
Along with the phrase, quotes, the dilutive mining of $300 million of FTT by an unauthorised source after the petition date, quotes.
And that just makes it sound like a Ponzi scheme. You just conjure new assets out of thin air.
Well, it does. And Mr. Bankman-Fried would recognise the comparison because it's one he made himself in one of his many unguarded media moments. And reporting since then suggests that a lot of assets from FTX have been moved to locations in the world where secrecy is the order of the day.
Which is an excellent point, right, to introduce the second path.
Oh, before you do, Graham, can I just make one last point?
Of course you can.
It's one I will leave others to draw their own conclusions from. But reading the reporting on FTX, it's clear that it grew its balance sheet from initial investors who put in fiat currency in exchange for crypto.
Well, yeah, I think that's the acceptable and accepted route.
Well, indeed. We call it on-ramping, yeah. It's equally clear that the money that's alleged to have been stolen is expected at some point to be off-ramped, i.e. turned back into fiat currency.
Meaning, if I've got your sense correctly, that the only apparent role for crypto in this particular use case is to act as a bridge between fiat on the way in and fiat on the way out, often with some significant changes of value both up and down in between.
Well, like I say, I'll leave it to others to make their own judgments, but it's a worthwhile debate, I think.
Yes. So, moving on, the Court of Justice of the European Union has recently handed down a judgment in relation to transparent beneficial ownership registers in the EU.
And it's not been well received in the world of anti-financial crime, has it, Graham?
No.
Should we summarise the judgment first?
Yes. Now, the first element rules that the requirement for member states to make all beneficial ownership information accessible in all cases to any member of the general public is invalid.
And secondly, that the general public's access to information on beneficial ownership constitutes a serious interference with the fundamental rights to respect for private life and to the protection of personal data, as enshrined in the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union and the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, respectively.
And this is where it gets interesting. The court also found that making the information available was an important part in the fight against money laundering and other financial crimes.
But the provisions in the AML directives were neither limited as to what was strictly necessary nor proportionate.
Yes. Now, of course, there's a lot more to this judgment than we can encapsulate in this podcast, but it seems to us that the court has missed an essential element of the benefits of a transparent and fully accessible register.
More than one, I would say. One of the consequences of being able to incorporate a limited liability company is inherent in its name. You can limit your liability if the company goes bust.
Which has to mean that someone else, be it the state or other individuals, pays some or all of the price.
Yes, Graham, as the investors in FTX are coming to know only too well.
Well, exactly. You also get, with a limited liability company, quite significant tax benefits from incorporating, don't you?
You do, which means there's less money going to the exchequer than if you were trading on your own account.
Tax advantages and protection from debt, a couple of really useful benefits.
Yeah, and having a limited liability company with those benefits is a choice, not a requirement. So, if you could make the case that there is a significant societal benefit from having fully accessible beneficial ownership registers, it would be reasonable to posit a quid pro quo relationship. Society offers you these tangible financial benefits, and in return, society requires full transparency of your ownership.
And if you don't fancy that deal, incorporate an unlimited liability company and take full responsibility for any debt you might accrue.
Privacy campaigners will tell you that goal can be achieved by allowing certain authorised entities like law enforcement and other government agencies, and even journalists who can demonstrate a specific need, to have access to the register. So, Graham, why does it have to be made available to the general public as well?
Because, Ray, that thesis is posited on the register being a secondary source of evidence. Now, by that, I mean you have to have a reason to go and look in the first place. Now, I think much of the work that we and others have done using the UK register, which is fully accessible freely to anybody, shows that with enough people putting in that effort, the register can become a primary source of potential criminality.
By which we mean it can provide the impetus for an investigation rather than supporting evidence.
Exactly. And it's a resource we can continue to make use of here in the UK, since it is not bound by this judgment.
Now, I thought the UK was still bound by the European Court of Justice, Graham. The Daily Mail's livid about it.
Well, no, Ray. The court that the UK is still bound by is the European Court of Human Rights, and that is not an EU institution.
Oh.
But it isn't bound any longer by the European Court of Justice. And anyway, this case wasn't heard in the European Court of Justice.
Eh?
Well, no. The European Court of Justice adjudicates cases between member states and hears applications from national courts. This case was brought by a private company, so it was heard in the Court of Justice of the European Union, which is different.
Of course it is. Well, I'm so glad we've clarified that one, Graham. Moving on. Yeah. Where does Lady or Baroness Moan come into all of this?
Ray, now, without in any way commenting on the veracity of the reporting.
Very good.
Thank you. The story is that she and her husband were instrumental in obtaining a large contract for PPE, personal protective equipment, in lockdown for a company with which they had a financial relationship.
And it also appears now that much of the PPE was useless and is incapable of being used.
Yes, it does. And again, according to the reports, a very large sum of money, and we're talking in the tens of millions of pounds, has been remitted to companies and personal trusts, of which the Baroness Moan and her husband are beneficial owners.
And again, without commenting on the specifics of this case, it's not too difficult to believe that if all beneficial ownership registers were fully and freely available to the general public, this sort of behaviour would be far harder to achieve and require much more in the way of shenanigans to get away with it.
It does, and that neatly draws our three stories together. The ability to own and control money or other assets of value and move them anonymously through the financial system consistently encourages corruption and organised crime and provides an unwarranted outlet for those seeking to avoid their creditors, whilst at the same time providing legitimate benefits for which society ultimately pays.
So it's criminals win-win and society lose-lose.
That's what it looked like to us anyway.
But there's another theme that unites our three stories, I'd say, Graham.
Oh.
Yeah, in trying to establish the actual facts in every one of these three cases, we've had to wade in the media, and media of all stripes, through an awful lot of overgeneralisation, sensationalism, false equivalence, speculation and catastrophism.
Well, we have. It's as though nobody wants to write, quotes, "there are things we don't know yet."
It's a sentiment that's gone out of fashion, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I don't have an answer, Ray, except to note that the longer the article, the more likely it is to be balanced and offer reasonable analysis rather than knee-jerk hysteria. That's particularly true of articles that only come out after the initial flurry, maybe a day or two or a week or two later.
Agreed. But one of the difficulties those articles face is that in an age of 280 characters and sound bites, many people are not inclined to read long, well-researched articles.
You are so right. And I suspect the ones who do are also less inclined to believe the initial knee-jerk reporting that we just mentioned.
That sounds entirely reasonable. Okay, we decided to do this episode instead of our planned review of your appearance at the UK Houses of Parliament, while the subjects were still very much in the news. So is the plan to go back and record your select committee thoughts and experiences next episode?
It is indeed.
I am looking forward to it.